In the book, I think you're saying that fracking is unique and that it's a private decision that a landowner makes to lease land, and it's between the company and the landowner, and it doesn't take into account the impact to the community or to the planet. You call that the public-private paradox. How did that manifest when it came to fracking in Lycoming County?
Pennsylvania is one of many oil and gas drilling states where more or less municipalities are not allowed to control or regulate fracking at the local level. What that means is that fracking, in my view, is actually less regulated than many other land uses at the local level, especially in a place like Pennsylvania. If you're a restaurant owner and you want a liquor license, you have to go through this whole process where people can comment and say, we don't need another liquor license. That will be too many people drunk driving on the road. But fracking, basically, while there still, of course, are public permit hearings, these are rubber stamps. This industrial use is allowed in every zone, even agricultural, even rural, where other industrial uses would not be allowed. The center point of the book is this interesting thing where private property rights are so sacrosanct and they're viewed as private, that I ought to be able to do what I want on my property, as if that's akin to free speech, right? But the idea of free speech is that my use of free speech does not inhibit you from using free speech. That's where this idea of what I call the public-private paradox comes into play, because the whole normal way that we think about individual liberty and private rights are you are allowed to exercise them because they are viewed as separate from the public sphere, right? You can love who you want to love, because if I marry somebody who's of the same sex as me, that doesn't inhibit somebody else from marrying somebody in the opposite sex as them. But leasing your land and otherwise using private property rights in ways that can create these spillover effects does have public impact and is in the public interest to be regulated, but it's legally framed as private. So on the ground in Lycoming County, like in so many other places in Pennsylvania, I followed families who that impact was explosive levels of methane in their water from their neighbor's gas well being drilled, the roads being torn up, people being unable to sleep and have their windows closed and their blinds drawn even on a summer day when they'd like to have them wide open because of the noise.
You know, you point out an irony in the book is that signing leases with the gas industry did impact the sovereignty of people over their land.
Yes.
Even the individual landowners, when you sign a lease, there were guards posted on their property that couldn't go up and down their driveway. They didn't have a lot of say in where the well pads were spaced. So they kind of lost what they prized most, which was control over their property.
That's right. One main character who I used to tell that story, although there's others as well, George Hagemeyer, who owned 77 acres, still owns 77 acres, but he leased. He was very supportive of drilling. He would be down there on the pad talking to the workers every day and, you know, would even say that people ought to make him a spokesperson for Anadarko Energy Company, who was the one who held the lease, because, you know, he just thought it was so exciting, not only making the money, but that he would be producing energy for America. And he actually made decent money. He did not wind up with any contamination. His first royalty check for just a couple months of production was $34,000. And in the end, when he came to my class to give a lecture, he told my class that he wished he didn't drill. And it was really sort of puzzling at first, because he wasn't one of these folks that had the worst happen to him. But what happened was, is he didn't realize, as you mentioned, how much of his own land sovereignty he had signed over. The fact that, you know, when they lease your property, as long as that lease lasts, which can be decades, of course, it's a 5-year lease unless they drill. If they drill, then it's in perpetuity as long as they are producing. They had said to him, don't go on the well pad, but he didn't really think that they meant much of it. They had installed a security camera that he didn't even know about. And he got a call when he walked on his well pad that he was going to be arrested. He didn't know that they were going to be withdrawing millions of gallons of water from a creek until he saw it published in the classified ads of the local newspaper. So all of these ways that he just didn't really understand how much that when they lease this land, it's their land in many ways.
And you write, you know, that George is not an environmentalist. He's not. And he's not a doesn't have a favorable opinion of anti-fracking activists.
That's correct.
You say in the book, anti-fracking activists should perform a postmortem on their efforts because they failed in large part to engage local residents in Lycoming County. How do you see that divide, and what could they have done differently?
So first I'll tell the divide in broader terms, because I think I didn't know it at the time, but what I found, this sort of disconnect between so-called fractivists and the local community, is pretty consistently shown across states. So there's a national debate about fracking, of course. It's a highly polarized issue, although in any locale, it's usually not polarized. Cities and coasts are mostly against it, and then the people who live in the rural heartland where most drilling is occurring are, for the most part, for it, Of course, there's some variation. And there's actually, even if you get more specific, the closer somebody lives to a natural gas well or oil well, the more likely they are to support it. How this played out here is that there was a local anti-drilling group called the Responsible Drilling Alliance, which was quite small. It's still there, only about a dozen sort of core members, and then a more expanded listserv. Often even they and what they were doing got lost amidst the much more vocal and occasional presence of activists from New York City, from Philadelphia, from Pittsburgh, who sometimes would literally come in on buses. And most infamously, even though it was in a neighboring county, everybody I talked to would talk about how when Yoko Ono and Sean Lennon and Susan Sarandon took this tour through Susquehanna County. And basically, this struck a lot of locals as off-key. And what is really fascinating about this is that if you look at the particular things, to go back again to the Responsible Drilling Alliance, which was the local group and was mostly quieter, a lot of the specific things they were pushing for, the ability of municipalities to control fracking through zoning, not allowing impoundment ponds, which often leaked if there's frack fluid in there, wanting to force companies to use water pipelines rather than driving all those trucks on the road, those were things that a lot of landowners supported. And they would could have gotten behind. But their idea of being against fracking was being a sort of liberal urban interloper who would come in and raise a stink and wasn't a part of the community and whose answer was always more regulation. That's the disconnect that I talk about there. What I think they could have done differently, and there were some people doing this. One of them, Ralph Kisberg, who's a co-founder of the Responsible Drilling Alliance, was doing this work. As hard as it sounds, I think you need to try to take the politics out of it entirely. So for instance, one of the things that Ralph and a couple other people from the Responsible Drilling Alliance would do, but not many others did, was if something went wrong with a community member, they would just show up and say, how can I help you? Like research their problem, like do Freedom of Information Act requests to find out as much as possible about the source of contamination, offer them pro bono legal help. And when Ralph did this, you know, he found that people were responsive. I mean, I do want to be careful. I don't mean to say that like everybody should just bend over backwards to cater to rural white working class people. But I do think that to the extent that, you know, a lot of folks who own land out here, they're fifth, sixth generation landowners. They see themselves as land stewards. It's not that they're opposed to any kinds of protection on the land. I just think that if the way that environmentalism gets framed as ban fracking and greater regulation over private land use, that those kinds of things are going to turn locals off.
There's also the issue of fracking on public land, state forest land. You write about the fight to preserve Loyal Sox State Forest, Rock Run, from fracking. And that's where there's pristine waterfalls and views and swimming holes. How is this different from what happened on private land?
A lot of people, a lot of locals supported it. And actually, once it was discovered that this portion of the Loyal Sock, colloquially called Rock Run, because of the stream Rock Run, but people sort of refer to the general area as Rock Run. Once it was discovered that this area was going to be drilled on, the Responsible Drilling Alliance actually had a pretty easy time getting hundreds of people to turn out at public hearings and events, you know, well over 12,000 people signing a petition, which for a small rural county is quite a lot. Had hearings in which state representatives from all over the state came, garnering, you know, statewide media attention. And so it was a big difference. It was actually the only campaign that the Responsible Drilling Alliance, I would argue, was successful on, like in mobilizing rural conservative landowners. And the difference here, I think, was, you know, for a lot of folks, and this is what showed me that people do have an understanding, even if they're quite individualist, of the public good. I think a lot of people understood that this was a beautiful, relatively pristine area that's surprisingly close to settled areas. And so even people who lived more suburban homes could, in 10 or 15 minutes, be out here and be swimming in a creek so pure you can drink out of it. People had a sense that this public good was at risk.
What if we learn from fracking that we can apply to other environmental concerns?
This is why I use this concept of the public-private paradox, where, again, just to reiterate, this idea that we see leasing as a private decision, but it actually should not be construed purely as a private decision because it impacts the public, both immediately, of course, your neighbors, but also the planet. So to me, the public-private paradox is a more transportable concept. You know, many of the decisions that you and I and other people make on a day-to-day basis, what kind of car I drive, how far I commute, how much I consume, how much I throw away, all of those things are basically viewed as purely private decisions in which we are not at all regulated or very lightly regulated. But all of those decisions impact people in the same way that leasing impacts neighbors. It's just usually harder for us to see because it might be the plastic in the ocean that we don't see. It might be rising seas that are inundating people in another country who have to relocate, or it might be future generations which don't even exist yet. And so to me, where I wind up is really that, and I'm not a policy expert for myself, so I don't have like a list of all the prescriptions of what to do with this. But I do think that this helps me understand why the United States is so disproportionately consumes world resources and disproportionately contributes to waste. We often frame it as sovereignty and rights, but I guess what we don't frame it as is how the externalities, the spillovers, infringe on other people's rights and sovereignty. And so that's the way I'm trying to shift the conversation, is to think that if we view profligate energy use and waste production as something that ought not be a private decision, that is actually a public decision, and if we explicitly link that to violating or infringing on other people's rights to enjoy environmental goods, other people's rights to continue to live in their home under sea level rise, then I think that maybe that can change the conversation a little bit. So that's my sort of broader argument.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.